Was it the secret desire to meet the savage warrior again that made me go back to the Cave of Skulls? Or was it the urge to confront my irrational fears? After all, I had begun to study archaeology and anthropology at the university, and neither the sight of human bones nor of human artifacts should send me tumbling into a panic. Or maybe it was simply the prospect of the endless months that I would have to spend enwombed in a cave, with nothing to do but keeping the body alive by ingesting food and drink, that made me want to fill my mind with new sensations as long as it was possible. Something for my thoughts and fantasies to dwell and feed upon in the upcoming time of loneliness and darkness. Whatever it was that made me go back I did. And this time I already knew what was there, and I was determined not to panic, but to investigate the findings with a rational mind, drawing upon whatever scientific education I had received. Determined not to succumb to the delusional encounters of any kind again. And one more thing was different this time. I had a lamp with me now. The hike from the Cave of Cairns to the Cave of Skulls I could do with bare feet, so I unwrapped my feet again, and the half of my former dress that had served as my left shoe I knotted into a satchel that I filled with a few cans of food and drink, with an oil lamp and a few matches. When climbing down the rope, I hung it around my neck, and so I arrived at the bay shortly after noon, feeling well prepared mentally and physically to investigate the place that had horrified me so much only the day before. Despite my determination, in front of the narrow dark opening I hesitated, considering to take a little snack before entering the cave. But this attempt at delaying what I had come for failed due to the fact that I had forgotten to bring one of the can openers with me. So, I lit the lamp, braced myself, and entered the cave. Even with the lamp, all I could see at first was darkness, but then my eyes adapted, and I took in the same scene that I had seen once before. Only I saw it more clearly now. The skulls on the walls, the altar, the idol. But this time, all this did not seem to be so frightful to me, and neither did I scream, nor did I run. I walked up to the altar. Yes, I was sure this was what it was, and had a closer look at it. It was an almost perfectly rectangular block of stone. Its sides were raw, but the top was smooth and carefully polished. The colour of this surface was dark, darker than the original colour of the rock from which the stone had been hewn. Reddish-brown, irregular, as if blotched. Blood, I thought with a shudder, as if the stone had been drenched in it. I touched it with my hand. It was dry, of course, but I could not say whether I touched stone or a coating of blood or of something else. And I do not think that I really wanted to know. Near the four corners there were holes, 2 or 3 inches of diameter, that led across the vertical edges, close to the top, connecting the short and long side faces. I took in the altar's size, and another shudder ran down my spine. A vision appeared in my mind of a human sacrifice, a naked girl stretched out upon the stone, spread-eagled on her back, her strained ankles and wrists tied with ropes that were threaded through these holes, and a nude priest was approaching her with a knife in his hand, and then the voices of many men and women filled the cave, chanting, shouting, laughing, and then they were standing in front of me, crowding the altar, blocking my view of the stone and the tired girl, and then I heard a scream. And then, as suddenly as the vision had appeared, it was gone. The scream had been my own, I realized. And the priest, had it been him? In the flickering light of the oil lamp, I had not seen his face clearly, and I could not say for sure. I took a few deep breaths to quiet down, and then, staying where I was, I looked across the altar at the idol. It was a life-sized figure in a comfortable sitting position, made out of dark polished stone. Black marble, it seemed to be, though I knew there was no such stone on this island. As I was not standing at the center of the altar, I was looking at the idol slightly from the side, and so I could see how the body of the deity merged into the solid block of stone upon which it sat, or rather, how it seemed to grow out of it, a three-dimensional altar relief, with a fully elaborated front side, from its head to its feet. The arms rested close to the upper body and thighs. Most striking about the figure was that it was both female and male. It had full breasts and it had a penis, a huge penis that was fully erect, proudly pointing upwards, and below the penis, visibly because the idol's legs were slightly spread, it had a scrotum that was divided, and in between the halves was a vulva, the pubic lips open in arousal, and I saw the dark opening of a vagina. And the face that had scared me so much when I had seen it the first time with its fiery stare, the eyes were indeed inlaid with a dark reddish stone. But there was neither life nor fire in them, and in the light of the lamp its expression seemed peaceful now. Not threatening, but rather, how could I call it, expectant and alert. I turned my head away from it to look at the skulls. They were everywhere, on the left and right walls. There must have been hundreds of them. I went and inspected some of the skulls closer. They all rested in niches that had been cut into the rock, and they were all undamaged, complete with lower jaws and teeth. From their sizes, they were all grown-ups, and, to judge from the state of the teeth, of rather young ones. Not past my own age, the unpleasant thought came. I was not an expert, but some of the skulls seemed to be rather new to me, while others seemed to be older, and some very old, maybe several hundred years. Several hundred skulls, several hundred years, another chilling thought forced itself upon my mind. Was there a skull for each year? Something that had begun a long time ago, and maybe was still going on? Was there another skull due this year? Who would the unlucky victim be who would have to die for it if he or she had not already died? I stepped deeper into the cave behind the altar and the idol, where the light from the cave's mouth did not reach. I had not been close to its back wall yet, assuming there even was one and the cave did not extend further and further into the mountain. But yes, soon I saw there was a back wall indeed, and by the light from my lamp I saw that it held a surprise. The wall was smoother than the side walls, and across its width of maybe 30 feet, it was covered with pictures. Simple drawings, no colours, only black. Probably drawn with sticks dipped into soot, but clearly legible. And if showing none of the artistry that the idol displayed, they were still done carefully and with attention to details. Arbitrarily, I started to read the pictures from left to right, and this proved to be the right direction. The first picture showed three boats out on the sea, open boats, outrigger canoes, each with one small triangular sail, and a crew of paddlers sitting in a row behind each other. I counted their tiny heads. There were exactly 12 in each boat. The next picture, or was it still a part of the first one, showed an island. This island. This must be the silhouette it presented to someone approaching from the west. Then there came a diagram with lines and circles and half circles that I did not understand, and then again a picture with the boats, and the crews pulling them ashore. Yes, this was the bay in front of this cave. The sailors of the first boat could be seen clearly. They were of both sexes, and they were all nude. There was no reason to assume that with the two other boats it would be different. I looked back at the diagram, and suddenly I realized that it was not difficult to read at all. There was the sun, the earth, different phases of the moon, lines that indicated the sun's and the moon's paths. It was a calendar. This must be the summer solstice, and in the first full moon to follow it, this is the second, this is the third, and this was the rising sun. And this line led to the picture with the arriving boats. Yes, this was the date and time, the morning of the day of the third full moon after the summer solstice. The third full moon. I did a quick calculation. Yes, there was no doubt. The boats were going to arrive tomorrow. Only one day, but I felt safe for now. Was it careless to trust them not to be early one day? To my own surprise, I easily shrugged that thought off and went on to study the pictures. With the next one, the horror began. It showed a scene of torture and rape, and so did the next one, and the next. All the victims were female, and their sufferings upon the altar were shown in detail. The cuttings, the flayings, the burnings, the breaking of bones, the rapes. And then, in a sudden revelation, I understood that these pictures did not show the tortures of many girls, but of a single one, of one who had to suffer it all. Her agonies must be beyond comprehension, and the pictures showed that, whatever was done to her body, she still lived. She still lived when there was nothing more left of her but her bleeding torso, her breasts long gone, but also her arms and her legs. And in another horrible picture, one that showed a scene outside the cave, one of her legs roasted over a fire while a woman cut off slices of meat from an arm, and several men and women stretched out their hands to receive their shares. She still lived, and they raped her again, not sparing her mouth. And the final picture showed her with the idol. I was not quite clear about it, but I had already seen enough. More than I wanted to see. I turned back to leave the cave, but then, passing the idol, I halted. I stepped closer and watched in fascination how by my lamp's light the huge penis cast flickering shadows on the cave's opposite wall. I had not noticed how big the penis was, how long its shaft. And its head, it looked more like the head of a mushroom, its rim protruding over the shaft's diameter and curved like an umbrella. A woman forcibly impaled on this instrument would have had her cervix penetrated, and then she would be stuck. Oh my God, I understood the last picture now. I saw the dying girl, or what was left of her, her mutilated arm and legless torso, one single bleeding wound. I saw her stuck upon that phallic stone spit that invaded her vagina and uterus in a terminally violent sexual act. I saw her shaken by convulsions. I saw her bleeding, deep-breasted chest heave in a desperate attempt of her broken ribs to suck in another painful gasp of air. I heard gurgling sounds emerge from her throat. I heard her trying to form words to come out of her mouth together with the flow of blood. I heard her speak those words. I heard what she said. And though I could not believe it, I heard her clearly. There was no doubt about it. I heard her say, Thank you. The upper part of her torso fell forward from exhaustion, her face coming to rest on that of the idol in what looked like a last passionate kiss. And still she lived. All the nude savages stood in a large circle around us now, keeping their distance, enclosing the altar, the idol, the dying girl, and me. They were silent. Their faces were solemn. Some of them masturbated slowly, but otherwise they did not move. Time seemed to be frozen. Then, slowly, one of them, a man, turned towards the cave's mouth and in a measured stride walked off. And when he had left the cave, the next one followed, equally silently and slowly, and then the next one, and the next one, until they were all gone. The ceremony was over, and soon the impaled girl would be dead, and then the birds and the insects and all the other small agents of nature would devour what had been left of her flesh, until nothing would remain of her body but her bones, and then her skeleton, not held together anymore by tendons and muscles and tissue and cartilages, would fall to pieces and finally be free. And now I saw, in confirmation of this harrowing mental scene, the bones that were lying on the ground on both sides of the idol. Her ribs, breastbone, hip bones, shoulder blades, vertebrae, the skull. Be careful not to touch her skull. It is sacred. I had not heard his voice at our first encounter, but I knew who the speaker was without having to turn around. I felt my knees getting weak. It must not be disturbed before we have determined its proper place upon the wall. I turned around now, and my knees gave in. The lamp slipped from my hand, fell to the floor, and went out. I felt his arms catching me, keeping me from falling, letting me softly glide to the floor. I was now kneeling before him, his erect penis touching my lips. I opened my mouth and took him in, and my mind went blank, overwhelmed by desire. And then I felt his hands upon my head, pushing it gently back, and he withdrew. "Not yet," he said. With soft force he turned me around, made me face the idol, guided my head. And then it was the idol's stone penis that my mouth enclosed, open as wide as possible to accommodate the cold hard glands that pressed against my teeth, my tongue, my gums. There were no hands to hold me now. I was alone. I stayed like this, my feet pressing against the altar, my hands resting on the idol's thighs, my head impaled on its sex. I did not move. I did not make a sound. I cried silently. For how long, I do not know. Finally, my tears dried up, and I raised my head and started to move. Not easily, all my muscles had cramped. My left foot touched something that was lying next to the altar, half hidden in a small crease. Not a bone, and not a lamp either, but something sharp and cold. In the near dark, I grabbed for it, glad to have something to distract my mind. It was a knife. I held it up so that some light from the entrance fell upon it, on the slightly curved blade, the color of which made me think of his skin, on the smooth, sturdy hilt of the polished black wood, and on the large glass crystal that was embedded in the hilt's end. Was it such a knife that he had carried the first time I had seen him? Was it such a knife? Was it this knife the unfortunate girls were dealt their fates with upon the altar? I sat down upon the altar, facing the cave's mouth, my feet dangling. I still wore my leather jacket, but my arse and legs touched the cold stone. I licked the blade clean, careful not to cut my lips or tongue. Then I drew it across my thighs, and once more higher, and then I let it touch my crotch. I did not cut deeply, and I hardly felt the pain, but I felt the blood flowing down my legs. With an effort, I stopped. What a place of madness this cave was. With even more effort, I got up and walked towards the light, and through the opening, and I was out again, in the bay, under the blue sky, the clear water of the sea before me. I took off the jacket and entered the icy water. The salt stung my cuts, but it also healed, and the water washed away the blood, and the chill cleared my mind. And when I got out, I felt almost all right again. I put on my jacket and found the knife lying under it. I had taken it with me without thinking. I looked at it again in the bright sunlight. Yes, I had seen right back in the cave. The blade was bronze, and the hilt was polished ebony, and the glass crystal. The glass crystal. Again my legs threatened to fail me. I stumbled towards a rock and sat down, my back resting against it. The glass crystal. I closed my eyes. I waited for my heart to regain its step. I opened my eyes again, and the crystal was still there. And it was still the size of a small seabird's egg. And it was still a diamond.